This is our fourth of six meetings on the pursuit of happiness. Hope it's going well. I've been really enjoying this time. It's a, kind of an experiment on all sides. This is the first time that I know of a community inviting someone to come and spend a fairly long period of time. Normally, the communities bring people in who lead retreats and then leave. And I think it's a very interesting experiment, and I'm enjoying this experiment very much. We may be making a little tiny bit of history here, and this may be a model for other communities. I'd like to give the downer talk that I almost gave last week. So, for those of you who are here for the first time, you picked the wrong night. I had lunch with some non-Buddhists last week, and they were asking me what I do, and I explained very briefly what I do, and one of the people said that he felt very connected to Buddhism, but the only problem that he found with Buddhism, and this is a very common comment in our society, is that it's so pessimistic. It's always talking about suffering. I think that comment would be true if there were only two and not four noble truths. That the Buddha talked about the fact that suffering exists and that there's a cause of suffering. But he also said that that there's a possibility to end suffering, and that there's actually a way to end suffering. So I find this tradition to be very optimistic, and yet we do talk a lot about suffering, and guess what we'll be talking about tonight? The Buddha said that suffering is not the true nature of the universe. And when we discover the true nature of the universe and really align ourselves with the true nature of the universe, then suffering ceases. But what the Four Noble Truths tell us is that in order to come to understand the true nature of the universe, we have to trace our way through suffering and its causes. It's not avoidable. The Buddha described the cause of suffering, the Second Noble Truth, is this very basic conditioning that we all have to try to experience only what is pleasant and to hold on to it and to try to avoid what is unpleasant. All of us do that. All of us have very profound conditioning to do that. We do not like to experience what is unpleasant. And so there's some way in which that's why we Buddhists have such a bad reputation for being such pessimists, is because we keep raising this issue. Somehow, discovering the true nature of the universe and really coming to true happiness has to do with deconstructing and eliminating, eventually eliminating those impulses to grasp for what is pleasant and to hold on to it, and to get rid of and keep away what is unpleasant. It has to be somewhere beyond that dynamic where our happiness lies. I think the most wonderful description that I've heard about what this path does for us, I heard secondhand actually from Michelle McDonald, who will be teaching here in August. And I share this information with you because she has shared it publicly. But, when Upandita Sayadaw, the great Burmese teacher, came and taught his first retreat here in 1984, Michelle took the retreat. And during the course of the retreat, she experienced memories for the first time of very, very severe incest that happened to her when she was 6 months old. And she went through a very, very difficult retreat coming dealing with this form of suffering that had been suppressed. And Upandita would give these talks. If you sat with him, you know he loves to talk about nirvana. And he would talk about how wonderful nirvana is and what joy comes from the experience of nirvana. And Michelle found herself feeling more and more uncomfortable in these talks because, and basically she eventually said to Upandita, you keep talking about nirvana, but that's not what I'm experiencing right now. I'm experiencing a great deal of pain. And it makes me uncomfortable to hear you talking about something that I have no experience of right now. And Upandita's response was just wonderful. He said, we don't practice this practice in order to taste nirvana. We practice this practice in order to create a mind that is ready for anything. I think it's so wonderful, that concept, because instead of something out here, some freedom out here, really what we're doing is forming a mind that can deal with anything, that is ready for anything. If you just think for a moment about what is it that you would least like to experience, what is it that you fear most, and can you imagine a mind that is ready to experience that? It would be a mind in which fear would not occur, in which fear would be eliminated. And I think it's quite wonderful. It really brings us right here to this moment. And my suggestion at the beginning of the sitting was, is it possible really to welcome everything that comes in your sitting? Just to really say, okay, here you are, you can be here. And that's the attitude that helps us to have a mind that is ready for anything. It means being willing to open to the forms of pain that we have, to open to our shadow. It's not news that we like to hear, but in order to have that mind that is ready for anything, it means being willing to experience all that a human being can experience and to allow it to be there. There's a wonderful expression of that, not from the Buddhist tradition, but from the Gnostic Christian tradition. In the Gospel of St. Thomas, one of the Gospels that was suppressed by the early church, where Jesus says, just wonderful, he says, if you bring forth what is within you, what you bring forth will save you. If you do not bring forth what is within you, what you do not bring forth will destroy you. If we can bring it forth, no matter what it is, no matter how painful it is, you know, the experience, the memory of incest is horribly painful, but the harm that was done by that can eventually be healed by re-experiencing the pain and going through it and purifying the consciousness of it. What we do not bring forth will destroy us. Carl Jung, who's the expert on this kind of stuff, said that what we don't bring to consciousness returns in our lives as fate. So it's not an easy thing to readjust our impulse to respond in a different way, to be able to open, to bring to consciousness that which is painful. But in fact, that's what is necessary. If we really want to experience happiness, we need to go through being willing to bring forth to consciousness all which is here. And all of us carry a great deal of painful material which is here. Jung also said, there is no birth of consciousness without pain. The birth pangs of our freedom. There are many ways of expressing how we got into this situation of being unwilling to experience what is painful. Basically, it has to do with the profound capacity of the human mind for denial. It's just amazing. I mean, when you really look at it, and we can look at it in our own minds, we can look at it in our culture, in our society. I work for an organization called Stop It Now, which is trying to stop the sexual abuse of children. And we have found in our work that basically that's the most important thing for us to work with, is the human capacity for denial. That most adults who sexually abuse children don't think that they're doing that. They think that the children want it or enjoy it. That the denial is that deep. And the people around can't afford to know that it's happening. And the society at large doesn't want to know that it's happening. So being able to somehow to work through this denial system, to expose ourselves, it's really, I think what we're finding in terms of just the issue of the sexual abuse of children, it's actually the taboo has not been molesting kids. The taboo has been talking about it. And as we talk about it more and more and more, then a change can happen. But it's a very interesting thing. I don't know if there's a wonderful book by Judith Lewis Herman on trauma. She talks about forms of social trauma. And she says that what happens is that when we learn about something terribly painful, like Vietnam, for example, as a culture, we kind of expose ourselves to that pain and then we shut down again. And over, from generation after generation after generation, we experience the pain and then we put it aside. And she said that one of the reasons for political movements is that it keeps it in our face so that we don't forget it. Very useful. Just on the personal level, how our denial system works, how the splitting off of painful things that we don't want to experience works, the best example I know of that, or the most colorful, comes from Robert Bly. This is from a book called Meeting the Shadow, The Hidden Power of the Dark Side of Human Nature. It's a wonderful anthology. And this is excerpted from his wonderful little book about the human shadow, which is called The Little Book About the Human Shadow. He says, let's talk about the personal shadow first. When we were 1 or 2 years old, we had what we might visualize as a 360-degree personality. Energy radiated from all parts of our body and all parts of our psyche. A child running is a living globe of energy. We had a ball of energy, all right, but one day we noticed that our parents didn't like certain parts of that ball. They said things like, "Can't you be still?" or, "It isn't nice to try to kill your brother." This chapter is called The Long Bag We Drag Behind Us. Behind us, we have an invisible bag. And the part of us our parents don't like, we, to keep our parents' love, put in the bag. By the time we go to school, our bag is quite large. Then our teachers have their say. Good children don't get angry over such things, so we take our anger and put it in the bag. By the time my brother and I were 12 in Madison, Minnesota, we were known as the Nice Bly Boys. Our bag was already a mile long. Then we do a lot of bag stuffing in high school. This time it's no longer the evil grown-ups that pressure us, but people our own age. So the student's paranoia about grown-ups can be misplaced. I lied all through high school automatically to try to be more like the basketball players. Any part of myself that was a little slow went into the bag. My sons are going through the process now. I watched my daughters, who were older, experience it. I noticed with dismay how much they put into the bag, but there was nothing their mother or I could do about it. Often my daughters seem to make their decision on the issue of fashion and collective ideas of beauty, and they suffered as much damage from other girls as they did from men. So I maintain that out of a round globe of energy, the 20-year-old ends up with a slice. We'll imagine a man who has a thin slice left. The rest is in the bag. And we'll imagine that he meets a woman. Let's say that they are both 24. She has a thin, elegant slice left. They join each other in a ceremony, and this union of two slices is called marriage. But even together, the two do not make up one person. Marriage, when the bag is large, entails loneliness during the honeymoon for that very reason. Of course, we all lie about it. How is your honeymoon? Wonderful. How's yours? Different cultures fill the bag with different contents. In Christian cultures, sexuality usually goes into the bag. With it goes much spontaneity. Marie-Louise von Franz warns us, on the other hand, not to sentimentalize primitive cultures by assuming that they have no bag at all. She says, in effect, that they have a different but sometimes even larger bag. They may put individuality into the bag or inventiveness. What the anthropologists know as participation mystique, or a mysterious communal mind, sounds lovely, but it can mean that tribal members all know exactly the same thing and no one knows anything else. It's possible that bags for all human beings are about the same size. So it's very interesting to see the dynamic, and Jung helped us so much to understand it. The dynamic of how actually we split off parts of ourselves. Really, I think what the path is, at least in this Buddhist tradition, is basically unstuffing that bag and bringing back by experiencing and then accepting all that which we do not want to experience from ourselves. And that to be whole, there is no other way to do it. John Lee once said that people use anywhere between 20% to 80% of their available energy resources to keep in sadness and anger. And I think I would add grief and loneliness to those two. So that what we do is that we not only are trying to hold stuff in, but we're also using so much of our vital energy to hold it in. And I certainly experienced myself with very severe depression that the whole system can actually lock down and shut down because all of the energy is being used to suppress anger and grief, you know, mostly. And so the suppression itself, the act of suppressing itself, becomes far more dangerous and far more painful than just experiencing anger and grief. You know? And it's quite wonderful, you know, when you do Vipassana practice long enough, you know, there aren't so many things that you're really dealing with. I mean, it's ultimately, you're just dealing with a few things. There's rage, you know, there's sadness and grief. There's a sense of isolation and loneliness. It's really very simple, and they all come, they just come back in different combinations. But once you really get to know them, they're just there. You know, oh, I know you, rage, or terror, or fear. It doesn't get to be. It becomes not such a big deal anymore. And when it starts to feel like it's no longer a big deal, that's a sign that we're beginning then to become whole again. That we can accommodate and integrate these qualities, these things, back into our psyche. And then they lose their power. You know, Bly goes on to say that what you split off ends up regressing and becoming very hostile toward you. You know, so something that was very healthy when we were little children, when we go back to it in our 20s or 30s or 40s, or later, has become very angry because it's been pushed away for so long. So what we do is we welcome it back in. And I think that has a lot to do with how we become happier in our lives. And I think it's very important. I think it's important not only for our own psyches, but it's really important for the health of our society, because precisely the same thing happens on the social level, that we have a collective shadow that we don't want to know about. And again, Bly has this wonderful image where he says, this was something that was written back in the 80s, but it really still applies. He said that we have to eat our shadows. And all of that shadow material, which we keep denying, goes up into the atmosphere, and Reagan has a big vacuum cleaner, basically, and he can collect it all and then use it against the Russians and the Chinese and all the others. You know, that basically it's our collective shadow which creates all of our enemies. And so by reclaiming our shadows as individuals and also reclaiming our shadow as a culture brings us to wholeness and happiness. And unfortunately, there's no birth of consciousness without pain. It means being willing to open to and to accept pain in our lives. And it's important. One of the statements that has most touched me, actually, in the last couple of decades comes from Elie Wiesel, who said, "Let us remember what hurts the victim most is not the cruelty of the oppressor, but the silence of the bystander." And basically, the silence of the bystander has to do with this unwillingness to experience the suffering that exists in the world and the pain that exists in the world. We wouldn't allow it in this world if we were willing to open to it. Well, that's briefer than usual. I understand it's a downer talk, but it feels to me like a necessary one. There's no other way to happiness except for our willingness to become 360 degree beings again. And in order to do that, it means being willing to open to all the levels of joy and also all the levels of pain that we hold in our psyches. Basically what we've been doing is looking at happiness and its causes and how to find it, how to cultivate it in our lives and the actual conduct of our lives. You know, we have actually a wonderful opportunity here because if normally in this kind of circumstance people would be in retreat together. Retreat is a wonderful, actually just a very wonderful structure for really looking at what's going on here. But it doesn't, you learn things in retreat, but you don't practice them on some level. And the opportunity that we have here with this particular form that we're doing with this experiment is that we're all in the midst of our daily lives. And so we get to look at our lives and actually what's happening in our lives in practicing where does happiness come from, how do we experience it, how do we prevent it from happening. So there's fortunately more time than usual this evening because I've been briefer. If you could, to follow this format that we've been developing here is that to get together with four or five people around you and just share what's been happening over the last week in terms of the subject of happiness. And if you could designate one person in each group to share anything that comes out of your discussion. We'll spend maybe 20 minutes in that